This is Professor Burke's criminal procedure class in room 238 on the 20th of November.
Thank you. the rest of the semester, which is really only today and one more class. So if you're looking at the old one, it's just we cut that last block, and then in the remaining block on effectiveness of counsel, I cut that middle line on assessing prejudice. So, but it's on Twin, and I also emailed it to you if you have questions on that. The final exam. As I already said, 3 hours, 75% multiple choice, 25% essay. It's closed book except for 5 8.5 by 11 inch pieces of paper, one sided only, of notes that you can bring in as a security blanket. I think you're all taking it when you're supposed to take it, and then there's one conflict exam. So if you're the one conflict exam, don't tell me, obviously. I don't want to know line grading or anything like that. But the one person who is in the taking it as a conflict exam, clearly whenever you've got exams, right, I can either write a separate exam or not. If it's a separate exam, then you're not getting the same exam everybody else is getting. There's always the question of what the professor should do in that situation. But regardless or not, if you're the one person, hopefully the one person is here, it is a serious violation of the honor code to talk to other students about an exam that you take before they take it. So, because even if I change the essay question, which I very may well, in my talk to them about what issues are in it or something like that, and that is cheating and strictly prohibited, serious violation of the honor code, I'll go after you and kick down the law school, and you will not graduate if that happens. So, do not. The person who takes that conflict exam, you are in a vault. You are in a bubble. Your lips are sealed. Do not talk to anybody else in the class about that exam, because I'll kill you and then I'll tell you that. That's serious enough. Okay, so let's talk about more pleasant things. Lineups. We were talking about eyewitness identification and court intervention here, instead of just letting it be strictly an evidentiary matter to be worked out by the trial court in its discretion. The court has created a constitutional dimension to identification processing. So we started by talking about the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And we know from what we already learned previously about the Sixth Amendment right to counsel in the confessions context that this attaches only after formal proceedings have occurred. But informal proceedings have occurred, the court held that an in-person lineup is a critical stage of the proceeding. And again, I think the rationale here is almost like with confession. I think that is very similar. Just like the court thought if the police deliberately elicit a confession from an indicted defendant, that really was the trial. I mean, it's going to determine the outcome of the trial in most cases, because once that confession has been obtained, the jury's going to need to hear about it, and then the rest of the trial, I mean, it matters, obviously, but the rest of the trial is going to be colored very much by that thing that happened outside of court. So the Supreme Court kind of takes the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and pulls it outside of the courtroom because the real action is taking place during the confession. Similarly, with eyewitness identification, I think Wade is a recognition by the court that a lineup, for all practical purposes, is it. It might not be part of the trial, might not be happening in the courtroom while the witness is sworn in, but it's the one that matters. Once the witness sees defendant and picks him out of the lineup, that's who they're going to keep identifying over and over again, including in the trial. So the real stuff is actually happening outside the courtroom, so the court pulls the Sixth Amendment right to counsel out and says, this is a critical stage of the proceeding, even though it's happening at police precinct or on the street or wherever it is taking place. So only after formal proceedings, but if it is and it's a critical stage, and the defendant has a right to counsel, just like he would have a right to counsel for a deliberate elicitation, just like he has a right to counsel for a trial, just like he has a right to counsel for a bail hearing, etc. Privilege. this works on the remedy side. The out-of-court ID, the court has it automatically get admissible. The separate question then is the in-court ID where you have a wait hearing. And here the court is supposed to, it's like I think of it as a fruits of the poisonous tree kind of analysis, where the court has to decide whether when the witness is sitting in the trial, sworn in, about to point to the defendant and say, yeah, that's the person who did this. Are they testifying from their actual memory, from their recollection? Is that why they're able to say that? Or instead, are they just parroting what, is there a risk that they are just parroting what they saw in this lineup when it was tainted? Is it the fruit of the poison tree, a fruit of the tainted lineup, or instead, does it come from somewhere else? Is there an independent source for that recollection? And we talked about all those factors. I won't repeat them all here, but they were all factors that went to the reliability of the witness, right? How long did the witness get to see the culprit? How much time passed between that and the lineup? If the witness gave any verbal descriptions of the suspect, did they match the defendant? How accurate did it appear to be? Did the eyewitness mistakenly identify other people first? Right, all of these things go to whether or not we think that eyewitness really has it right, or whether there might be too much of a risk that her memory is tainted from the lineup itself. So, and the standard here is clear and convincing evidence. Well, what winds up happening because of Wade is the trial court winds up taking this question, what we normally do, a factual question, right? In a trial with an eyewitness, these are normally the kinds of things that the defense attorney and the prosecutor are going to be arguing to the jury. The defense attorney would argue to the jury, she falsely identified three other people before she picked the defendant, she only saw for 15 minutes, the light is bad. Those are all the kinds of things that get argued to the jury, and it's a matter of fact-finding, right, that we usually leave to jurors. The result of Wade, at least if there's a Sixth Amendment violation, the in-court ID becomes a constitutional issue for the judge rather than, and then also it's a question for the jury, of course. So just the issue of whether it's even admissible, whether the witness is allowed to identify the defendant in court, becomes an issue of a constitutional dimension for the trial court, not just for the jury. I think when we ended class, we were talking about what attorneys should do. If an attorney is called to a lineup because it's post-indictment and the police are doing that, what's best for the defense attorney to do? If it's a really flawed lineup, it's a terrible lineup, and there's one blonde and five brunettes, and this assailant was described to be blonde, that's a major problem. So the question is, do you fix it, or do you let the problems occur and then have yourself a pretty good argument under due process, which we'll talk about in a second, that is so unreliable it shouldn't even be admitted as a matter of due process. Even if that fails, you could then argue to the jury that lineup means nothing. It was one blonde guy and five brunettes. What does that mean? They stack the deck and shouldn't be able to do that. Maybe a good defense strategy would be to let it be messed up. Still, though, there's value to having the defense attorney there. Whether they fix it and make it reliable, which has strategic downsides, because if they fix it and make it reliable, and then the witness identifies the defendant anyway, now the guy's really toast. Okay. So they can either fix it, or they can see that it's flawed, take notes on that, have stuff to use at trial, both on a motion to suppress for due process grounds, and also at trial to argue to the jury that this is an unreliable format for the ID. So some strategic concerns there. One other thing to take note of is, in reality, Wade violations are pretty rare because police avoid Wade by doing lineups prior to the event. As long as they do the lineup prior to the initiation of formal proceedings, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel has been attached, weighed and irrelevant, and there's no Sixth Amendment argument to be made. The other limitation on, maybe I'll ask you guys this. So, let's say you were a police officer, and the defendant's already been indicted in a robbery, and then you find another witness, a witness that you previously hadn't been able to find. They ran out of the store during the robbery, and they weren't there when you responded to the crime scene. You've been trying to track the person down. You finally find them. Unfortunately, the defendant's already been indicted, and so therefore enjoys weight protection. You can't do a lineup, but you'd love to have this witness identify the defendant in some way. How could that be done? Or can it be done? Without going through the defense
lawyer. A photo lineup?
Okay, and why can that be done?
Because you're not calling in the defendant to, so you're not, it's not a critical stage for the defendant because they're not involved.
Right. So, only if it's an in-person ID. The court held in U.S. versus Ash that Wade did not apply to a photographic lineup, a photographic array, which is a common way of doing this. So just booking photos are almost, you know, any real jurisdiction has all that computerized. You can pick up your suspect's booking photo and then look for five other booking photos of people who you don't care about, who kind of look like your guy. You throw it all in array, you put it down in front of the witness, and you have the witness mark the picture that he or she thinks is the suspect, the person who did it. And the court held in Ash that Wade didn't apply to that, but that was not a critical stage of the proceedings. And again, I think the way to look at this, well, what guides a critical stage of the proceedings? It's a critical stage of the proceedings if that's it, if it's like the trial or sentencing. It's like the case being litigated. And in-person IDs can't be replicated, although you pointed out now they photographed them. So that's actually an interesting question of whether that undermines weight because there it is being replicated. But the court's reasoning in Ash was that unlike in-person identification, a photographic array is easily replicated in trial, right? I mean, you can show it to the jury, and you can say this is what the witness was shown, and if it's one blonde guy and five brunettes, the jurors are going to be able to realize that that was messed up, because they'll be able to figure that out on their own. The court will be able to see whether it's messed up as a matter of due process. Okay. So there aren't the same kinds of replication concerns. So it's only if it's an in-person ID. So as a result of all of that, Wade is really pretty limited. I mean, you're only talking about in-person identifications after indictment. That's it. So that's usually not the case. Even if it is the case, what the government has to do is bring a lawyer. It's not that they can't do it. It's just that he has a right to have a lawyer there, and the lawyer may not even be in the way. Right? It's a matter of having the lawyer there. I think the court's feeling was that would be a deterrent to bad behavior. Okay. Most of the litigation on eyewitness IDs actually takes place under due process because of the limitations of Wade, that it has to be post-indictment, that it's only in-person ID. The origin of this line of cases is Stovall versus Deno. Page 23. This happened in Garden City, actually. I lived in Garden City for 2 years, and my impression of Garden City is that there weren't very many murders there. I never really looked that up, but my guess is it's not the hotbed of violence. But it's a pretty gruesome case. The Garden City homicide, the husband was killed, and the wife survived but was badly injured. And she was in the hospital after the incident took place, and they honed in on a suspect, and they bring him to the hospital room where she is trying to recover. And it had been a day and a half since her husband had been killed, she had been in the hospital that entire time. And they bring the suspect in by himself, right? He's the only suspect there. They didn't do a lineup. They just stuck this guy in front of her. She had described the assailant as being an African-American male. He was the only African-American male in the room. And they just put him in front of her and say, "Is this the guy?" And she says, "Yes." She ICs him. What result? He moves to suppress and says, he argues that this is a due process violation, that it would be unconstitutional, be fundamentally unfair to allow the jury to hear about this identification. Jessica? Hi. What result? Okay, why?
I think they take a sort of logic that says Don is going to be the only person who can nominate himself, so he would be giving anything out to the defendant as well as himself.
So the court, on the one hand, the court gives defendants something in the case by recognizing that there's a constitutional dimension to identification, even if a person, even if you're not talking about the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. But they say the due process prohibits unnecessary suggestiveness. The court recognizes that this is suggestive. I mean, certainly it's suggestive, right? There's only one person that she can pick. She can say yes or no, that's it. There's nobody else to pick. She said it was an African-American male. They show her one African-American male and they say, "Is this the guy?" It's suggestive. It is not the most reliable process to use to test one's memory. But the court is going to allow the informality when necessary. And as Jessica points out, the court said it was necessary to do this quickly. The victim had been in the hospital for a day and a half. It was unclear whether she was going to make it. And they said, you know, look, she was the one last person who could have saved the defendant because she could have cleared him. She could have exonerated him and said, no, he's not the guy. And if she had died in the time it took to do a lineup, that would be a horrible thing for him. Well, she didn't exonerate him. She said, yeah, that's the guy. Okay, but the court said, look, it was necessary to do this quickly, and therefore it wasn't a due process violation. And the result of that is the court allowed both the in-court ID and the out-of-court ID into evidence. The jury got to hear both about the fact that she identified him in the hospital room, and then on top of that, she was allowed to identify him in court and to say, yeah, that's the guy, during the trial. Now, the court's opinion in Stovall doesn't make clear. There's two possible readings in Stovall, of Stovall, I think. The court could have been saying if the police use unnecessary suggestiveness, then there's automatic exclusion. Or perhaps one should read Stovall more narrowly and say the court just didn't address what should happen if the government uses unnecessary suggestiveness, because in Stovall, the government didn't use unnecessary suggestiveness. They used necessary suggestiveness. Well, Stovall, the case decided since Stovall made clear that what's really going on here is reliability. We don't get to that question in Stovall because in Stovall, the court held that this wasn't a due process violation at all because, yeah, it was suggested, but it was necessarily so. They had to act quickly. They had to stick the guy in front of her so that she could exonerate him if she was going to do that. If no, then you have no problem. So if there's no unnecessary suggestiveness, there's no problem there. If yes, then what? Let's say that she wasn't in the hospital. She made it. She was in the clear. She was at home watching, what would one watch in 1961? Leave It to Beaver. She was at home watching Leave It to Beaver. She was fine. She was out of the woods. There was no rush. And they showed up at her house in the living room with one guy, stuck him in front of her and said, "Is this the guy?" Then what? Did it have to what?
Did it have to see if it was reasonable to be dead?
And then what?
And then they would be able to do it, and it would be violating the promise.
What if the assailant was her son? She would be prohibited from testifying.
The assailant was her son. The assailant number should have to find that question.
What if they did? What if they took her son in front of her and said, "Is it the guy?" And she said, "The guy is my son."
Okay.
Doesn't unnecessarily suggest a procedure.
But she already herself.
Okay, so does that change the result? Okay, why?
Because she has a prior relationship. And if you have a prior relationship with her, you don't have to identify.
Okay, so you just told me a second ago, though, before it was the son, you said they can't use her identification.
Right.
Okay,
well,
why not?
Because it's unnecessary. He's suggesting. And
why does that change if she knows it?
Because
they still unnecessarily suggest it. So the answer is
the identification is based upon that, is based upon what she knows herself. You understand?
Yes, I do. What if it's not her son, but the murderer of her husband arose out of an incident where the assailant kept her and her husband kidnapped in the house for 3 days? She saw him for 3 days. And the guy finally told her husband, she gets away. 2 days later, she's in the clear watching Brady Bunch. They show up with the suspect and say, "Is this the guy?" She says, "Yeah, it's the guy. It's just the baby." Can they use that?
I would think so. Independent source.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
In terms of that, if there's another, if you can prove that there was another method or matter by which she could identify the suspect beyond the actual, beyond the lineup or the event itself.
Okay. The court for due process violations did not use any kind of automatic suppression of identification, either for in-court IDs or out-of-court IDs. Look at Neal versus Biggers in your casebook at 827. Here, the police, unlike in Stovall, the police used an unnecessarily suggestive show-up, is the language, as opposed to a lineup where you have multiple people and the suspect's one of them and the rest of them are decoys. A show-up is where you just take the one guy or one girl, woman, and say, "Is this the person? Is this the culprit?" That's a show-up. They did that in Stovall, but the court said it was necessary. It was, had to be fast, she might die. It wasn't unnecessarily suggested. In Neal versus Bigger, the police used a show up and said, "Well, we couldn't find enough people to be decoys." That's lame. You can't use that as an excuse. That's not necessary suggestiveness. That's not because of someone about to die or you've got to be fast. There was no urgency to any of this. They were just too lazy to go around and find appropriate decoys. And the court says, that's not necessary. You need to go and try to build a lineup unless there's a reason why you can't. So they used an unnecessarily suggestive procedure. And yet, the court held that the victim's identification of the defendant was still still admissible because it wasn't the product of the suggestibility of the procedure. With the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, what we're worried about is the deprivation of the right to counsel. With due process, what we're directly worried about is the suggestiveness of the procedure. Right? You stick one person in front of the victim, and the victim's going to say, "Yeah, that's him," and then she's going to keep identifying him over and over and over again. So we're worried about it being the product of that suggestive procedure. But the court said in Biggers that the victim's memory had been proven to be the product of her own recollection, not of this, admittedly poor procedure. Right? The court grants the defendant that it is a poor procedure, it's unnecessarily suggested. Nevertheless, the victim's allowed to identify the defendant because she has independent source. It's the same analysis that we talk about in the Wade context for the in-court ID. Where what the court needs to do is ask whether or not the victim's identification, whether it be the out-of-court one or the in-court one, is the product of the victim's own recollection, the witness's own recollection, or whether instead it might be the product of a tainted procedure. In this case, in Biggers, they said that the victim had an independent source, her own recollection, for her identification. It was a rape case, so the nature of the case made it very different from a purse snatching, for example, right? It was not a quick fleeting glance at the assailant. The nature of the crime, the sexual assault, made it so that she was, by definition, right, close to the person, the ability to observe the person, not for just a fleeting moment, right? There was a prolonged exposure to the suspect. And so, therefore, she had more opportunity to observe him. She gave a detailed description of the defendant to the police shortly after the crime. He matched that description. So there were facts to suggest that she was identifying him accurately. She was not doing this just because of this screwy procedure that they had used. So it's just like the factors that we talked about in Wade for determining the admissibility of the in-court identification. Okay, but for a due process argument, it applies to both the in-court ID and the out-of-court ID. There's no per se rule of exclusion for either. Manson versus Brathwaite, which is the case that your book uses as for full case treatment. I mean, that really completes what I think Biggers already started, because the court made clear in Justice Blackmun's opinion in Manson that the linchpin for determining admissibility is the challenge based on due process, as opposed to a post-indictment in-person ID where you're talking about the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. If what the issue is due process, then reliability is the linchpin for determining whether the ID is admissible. In Manson, the police used a photographic show-up. And again, here it doesn't matter whether it's an in-person ID or whether it's photographic ID. Why? Because it's a different doctrinal claim. We're not worried about the right to counsel this time. What we're worried about is suggestibility. And photographic IDs can be at least as suggestive as in-person IDs. So here the police use a photographic show-up without any exigency. And the facts are kind of weird. The police officer, there's an undercover police officer had done a controlled drug buy with the suspect. And there was a picture. Another police officer recognized the undercover officer's description. Right? They were like, hey, I think I know who that person is. They went and got a picture. This other police officer went and got a picture of the person they had in mind. Leave it on the undercover officer's desk. So, you know, is this the guy that you did the drug deal with? And the undercover police officer looks at it and says, yeah. Seems like a reasonable thing to do, but at the end of the day, what the police officer did is something he wouldn't be able to do with any other witness. So implicitly, the court is saying it's not okay to do that with an undercover officer either. Their memories are just as valuable as well. We'll talk about that, whether it's really just as valuable. But they are the witness, right? And the police officer just showed him one picture and said, is this the guy? That's suggestive, and it was done unnecessarily so. They could have done a photo array, and the police officer didn't do that. Nevertheless, the court said, well, wait a second, that doesn't necessarily mean that the identification can't come in. They say reliability is a linchpin. We've got to look at the same factors we looked at in Wade for determining the admissibility of the in-court ID. We have to look at it here to determine the admissibility of both. And here the court says the undercover police officer had a good opportunity to view the defendant, right? There was good light, and he saw the defendant directly for a sufficient amount of time to form a memory of his face. The degree of attention, and here the court gives the undercover police officer a little boost saying that, you know, he's a trained police officer, unlike a layperson. He's paying attention, right? It's his job being there to remember who this person is. He's looking at him, not just as a person, but as a trained police officer on duty, looking at the person. The court even takes note of the fact that it's the same race. There's empirical evidence that suggests people are really not very good at cross-racial identification. You know, there's that joke, right, that people say, oh, it all looks the same to me. You know, well, that actually has some empirical basis to it, that and it's not just white people can't identify people of color, it's anybody, right? So Asians can't identify, all white people look the same to me, I guess. I don't know. But it's a matter of outside one's own race. Accuracy for faces goes down. So the court notes that this doesn't have that dimension to it. It's the same race identification. The police officer, the undercover police officer's initial description had been accurate. In fact, it was so accurate, it made this other police officer, just based on the verbal description alone, say, hey, I know who that guy is. There's a picture, right? So apparently the undercover's verbal description of the guy had been pretty accurate. The level of certainty the court takes into account. Some psychologists actually disagree with this, although the court does weigh level of certainty as a factor on a liability. There's some empirical evidence to suggest that the level of security a witness has, like the level of confidence a witness has in the accuracy of their identification, has no correlation at all, and perhaps even a negative correlation with actual accuracy. So the court actually, the psychological matter, is a little bit wrong there. Okay, but in real life, you will hear, during these hearings, you'll hear parties say, she was said she was 100% sure that's a factor that goes into the mix. And the time between the crime and the identification was only 2 days. So when the court put it all together, they said that the identification could come in. I don't think this stuff is, so hard. I don't think it's hard. If you guys have questions, interrupt me, but I'm kind of flying through it, because I think it's pretty straightforward. When you put it all together, you just have to look at, just like with confessions, I said you should look at each line of cases separately and do the analysis. I think the same is true here. Most of the time, in a fact pattern, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel issue is going to fall out pretty quickly, either because the person's not indicted yet or hasn't been charged yet, or if it's not an in-person ID. And so both of those have to be true. It's got to be an in-person ID after the person's been charged, which is pretty rare. So usually the issue will fall out. If it doesn't, the question is whether their right to counsel was respected. If not, what's the remedy? This part's easy because it's automatic. The out-of-court ID is gone. Okay, so the results of the lineup are gone. And then the only question is whether there can be an in-court ID, and then it's arguable liability. It's the same thing. If I were to give you, if we weren't pro pro, as well as constitutional law, if it was a mock trial class, and I gave you a kind of straightforward robbery case where it was a one-witness ID of a robbery and asked you guys to argue, my guess is you're probably pretty good at that. You go through the police report, you interview the witness, you get both sides of the argument, depending which side you were on, right? You either argue that the person is totally unreliable, argue the prosecutor, you say they were really reliable and got a good look at the person and there was good light and all of that. It's not the hardest job to do. It's a matter of litigation, arguing whether an eyewitness is reliable or not. All this does is take what would happen and will probably happen at trial anyway, but give it a constitutional dimension, so it becomes not just something you can argue to the jury, but it becomes a way to keep the identification out of the jury's hands at all, so that they never get to hear it if the trial court thinks it's unreliable in a constitutional sense. Unconstitutional. Okay. The other thing I wanted to point out here, the reliability inquiry on a due process claim, if it's unnecessarily suggested, it takes place for both the out-of-court ID and in-court ID. And usually, if the government loses on a reliability issue, they're going to lose both. Does that make sense? Usually, they rise or fall together. Either the person knew what they were talking about, or they don't. I suppose there could be a situation where you have a reliable out-of-court identification. You have to mess with the facts a little bit. I suppose you could have a reliable out-of-court identification where, you know, take the facts bigger, where she had an extended amount of time to see the person who assaulted her, her description was accurate, all of that. And then they show the guy to her, is this the guy? She says yes. It's unnecessarily suggestive, but we think she knew what she was talking about anyway because she saw all of this, right? Then the out-of-court ID would be reliable enough to come in. If the next day, if they kept showing her the same picture over and over again, no, I'm going off on that. It really is hard to come up with a situation where one comes in and the other does not. They usually rise and fall together. I can maybe make up one where the out-of-court ID is reliable and the in-court isn't. Like, I guess a 5 years passed. I know, tough. I actually had a case like this. I had a case one time where, like, some of that was a case, but the guy got picked up on a warrant like 7 years after the original case had happened. And it wasn't like a murder case where somebody's paying attention to the guy for 7 years. He was like a homeless person whose original offense was unlawful possession of a weapon, I think, you know, something pretty minor. And he had gotten arrested for unlawful possession of weapon. They booked him, all of that. And then he didn't get picked up on the warrant for 7 years. Well, day of trial, the police officer comes in and goes, I gotta be honest with you, I don't remember this at all. I'm looking at the police report, I recognize my handwriting, so I believe that it's me who wrote all of this down. But if you ask me to identify him, I really don't know. Never seen the guy. I mean, I don't remember seeing the guy. I'm sure I have. I don't remember seeing him. I can't tell you today whether it's him or not. That might be an example where the in-court identification shouldn't come in if I took a picture and said, this is the picture that you took the day you arrested him. Is that a guy? And he said, yeah. That might be a situation where the in-court identification would be unreliable. But if there had been an out-of-court ID 7 years ago, right, if 7 years ago somebody had said, this is the guy who had the weapon, and he said yes, and I had a record of that out-of-court ID, that would come in. Okay, but if 7 years had passed, then the in-court ID might be unreliable, if that makes sense. I'm definitely sure it doesn't work the other way around. If the out-of-court ID is bad, if it's so suggestive that we think that when the show-up happened, the witness would just say, yeah, because it was unnecessarily suggestive and not because she actually remembered who she saw, I don't see any way an in-court ID can come in. If she didn't know what she was talking about before the trial, shortly after the incident, there's no way that she suddenly knew what she was talking about day of trial. So usually these things rise and fall together. In the wave context, is more of a distinction because the remedy is different for an out-of-court ID and an in-court ID. It wouldn't be right for me to not point out that in reality, all of these claims are hard to make. I mean, for the defendant. There's a tendency for trial courts to say, no, just let the jury figure this out. It's hard for defendants to make these claims because, first of all, Wade, which at least does have some amount of an automatic remedy, is doctrinally so narrow. They have to be indicted and it has to be an in-person lineup, and that doesn't happen very often. Most defendants are left making only a due process claim, and the reality is it's not that hard for the government to persuade a court to let it be a jury question. For example, right, Stovall makes that clear, that if it's necessarily suggestive, it's okay. Many lower courts, if it is a situation right after, let's say there's been a robbery at the Subway sandwich shop, and the police arrest a suspect running through the Hofstra Law School parking lot. And they want to get this done quick, right? They don't have probable cause. They only have reasonable suspicion. They have to act quickly, efficiently. They can't put together a lineup. So instead, they either take the suspect back to Subway Sandwich to be shown up to the witness, or perhaps more smartly because of Terry restrictions, right? They might bring the witness to the Hofstra Law School parking lot and say, is this the guy? That's very suggestive. Who else is she going to point to? The police in the uniform? Of course not. There's a tendency for witnesses to think, well, he found him. He must be the guy. Yeah, that's the guy. That's a suggestive procedure, but many courts will say that's necessarily suggestive. It was only a Terry stop. They had to act quickly. There's no time to do a lineup. It's better to know very quickly, is this the guy or not? If it's not, you got to keep looking around the neighborhood to find the other fleeing guys from the neighborhood. If it is him, they can start to do things in a more formal way. Right? So courts allow a certain amount of informality here when it's right after the offense. Even when it's unnecessarily suggestive, it's not that hard for the government to show reliability. Look at Foster versus California. After your on May 27th, before Manson, I point out Foster because it's the only time the Supreme Court in this line of cases held an identification to be inadmissible under Stovall, and they suppressed both the in-court and out-of-court identifications. They used a three-person lineup with two short people and the defendant. Only he was the height of the description that had been given, and two shorter people. And he was still wearing the same exact jacket that the victim had described. Right? So it would be the equivalent of, right? I mean, the victim saying he was wearing a Sean John jacket or something, and then you stick one guy wearing a Sean John jacket in a three-person lineup. That's a pretty heavy nut, right? Take number two in the Sean John jacket. And the victim still didn't ID Foster as the guy. So then they pulled him out. They just had only Foster step forward and presented him on a one-on-one show-up. Is this the guy? The same person that had just been in the three-person lineup, she's not seeing the other two, just this one. Is this the guy? And still, she says no. And then finally, they put him in a second lineup where he's the only person who's the same. The two short people are gone, and they bring in a bunch of other people. He's the same guy with a bunch of different people, and they say, now he went into this, and finally she picks Foster. Okay. That's crazy, right? I mean, that's just ridiculous. And there the court said, okay, that's unnecessarily suggestive, and we don't think that she was testifying from her own recollection. We think she was just saying what she was nudged to say through these unnecessarily suggestive procedures. Nicholas?
Yeah, I just have to regarding these three identifications. It seems to go against the liability factor, though, because if something's quick as that, while the people who are being victimized actually pay attention to what's going on, or they focus strictly on maybe a weapon or another part of stuff, there's so much chaos. So I don't see how, if they don't need the fact of the fence, so I still see how it's
because you're not there yet. The court, and I'm glad you pointed it out, but I want to make it really clear. If the court thinks that the procedure, although suggestive, was necessarily suggestive, there's no due process question. It falls out. So if no, there's no unnecessary suggestiveness, there's no problem. Even if it seems highly unreliable, right? Even if the witness seems like it's all a play, and they, she said, I got a fleeting glance at him. He was blonde. He was 6 feet tall. And then they find him in the Subway parking lot. They find a guy running through the Hofstra parking lot and show him to her. And it turns out he's actually only 5'2", and has black hair, not blonde hair. And she goes, oh yeah, that's him. You don't even get this question under a federal due process claim. It's only if there's unnecessary suggestiveness that you even get there. So if you go back and look at Saval, they don't really talk about whether she's to be trusted. What matters is she was in the hospital and she might die. So it had to be done quickly. There was no, you only get to reliability if it is unnecessarily suggestive. So I'm glad you made that clear. You said something interesting. Oh, they might be focused on the web. There's empirical evidence on that too, that when people are confronted with a situation when they're afraid and there's a weapon involved, they hone in on the weapon and see that to the detriment of the face of the person carrying it. They only see the gun, they don't see the person holding the gun. There is a certain industry of psychologists who testify as expert witnesses. So for those of you who have had evidence, right, you know that there is the ability to be expert witnesses to help the jury decide questions that are sort of beyond them. There is an industry of people who testify on the accuracy of eyewitness identification. So even if it doesn't happen at a constitutional level, what we're talking about here is pretty extraordinary, right? You're talking about a judge saying, this is so unreliable, I'm not even going to let the jury hear about it, right? It's so dangerous that the jury will think it's real, they're not going to be able to sort through the truth. There's a tendency for trial courts to say, you know what, I'm just going to let the jury figure this out. Yeah, they use a screwed procedure, but she seems to kind of know what she's talking about. We'll let the jury decide whether to believe her or not, whether they think she's a good witness or not. And for defendants who can afford it, they can hire experts to come in and tell the jury about cross-racial identification problems, about planted memories, about the unreliability of memory, about focusing on weapons and not faces. So there's definitely a litigation industry out there of psychologists to do this. I just mentioned that when I was an undergraduate, I did research for, my professor did research in this area. But we went up and met with Elizabeth Loftus, who's kind of one of the famous people who does this work. And this was years ago. This was before she was like super famous, Elizabeth Loftus. This is when she was just Elizabeth Loftus at the University of Washington, who was willing to have lunch with me and my professor. But we went for lunch at her house, and she was going through this art catalog, and she wanted me to help pick out which Andy Warhol Mick Jagger portrait she should buy. And I'm like, okay, you're not buying this money from UW. You're not buying this on professor money. You're getting this from expert witness money. So there's definitely like an industry out there of experts who get paid to do this. Prosecutors hate them. There's definitely some truth to what the experts have to say. Okay, take a break until 10 after, and we'll talk about the right to counsel. I'm
Thank you.
right counsel should probably, instead of being at the very end of class, should be at the, maybe we do it for 2 days before we get to all the Fourth Amendment stuff, because we've really been talking about the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, both in the confession context and the eyewitness identification context, where the court has kind of stretched the Sixth Amendment right to counsel without talking about the core of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel itself. But that's where we now are, is the core of that right. So now we've been studying it in a pretrial context, interrogation, deliberate interrogation, and eyewitness identification, violence, in-person violence. So in those contexts, in Messiah and Wade for interrogation and in-person ID, it was much more controversial, right? That's the court really stretching the limit of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, finding that things that take place in a police precinct are really part of the trial, even though it's prior to the trial. Pretty controversial extensions of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. The role of counsel at trial and even post-trial proceedings is much less in dispute. It has a stronger historical basis. And there's also, I think, more agreement. There's been more historical consensus that defense attorneys have a legitimate and useful and proper role, as opposed to an obstructionist role, to play in these contexts, you know, in court, doing kind of traditional lawyerly types of things. The issue in the early right to counsel cases was really the right to court-appointed counsel. It had always been the case, part of the American tradition, that people who could afford to have a lawyer could do so, right? But the real issue was, well, what do we do about people who are indigent and can't afford to pay their lawyers? And that's really what these cases are about. The reality is that the overwhelming majority, I read somewhere it was more than 80% of defendants use court-appointed counsel. My guess, I would have put it at 90. I would have said it was more like 90, just based on my own recollection of that, if not higher. But the reality is an overwhelming majority. And jurisdictions use, there's different systems that jurisdictions can use to fulfill what is now a constitutional obligation to provide court-appointed counsel to indigent defendants. Perhaps the most common way is to use a public defender's system, where there is a law office that handles only those indigent defense cases. That's what the lawyers do. That's your job. You're a public defender, and that's what you do. That's what this firm, to a certain extent, is what I call a law firm, does. Another way to do it is to bid out the work. Right, so that lawyers who, they don't work for a public defender, they might be solo practitioners, or it might be a small firm of 10 people or even 40 people, and the county, let's say, that's prosecuting the cases can have a contract with this firm. You do all of the misdemeanor DUI cases, and this is how we'll pay you. We'll either let you bill your time, or pay. It's common bill. Pay by the case, you know, you get $500 for every DUI misdemeanor case that your firm handles, whether it goes to trial or whether it pleads. And so you can do a contract basis either with solo practitioners or small firms, where the government farms out this work to lawyers who might have other things in their practice as well, and they're not public defenders. And then another way to do it is to have a list. And some jurisdictions do this, where they'll just have, not a firm, not kind of this collective, we'll give you this big body of cases. You do all the DUIs, or you do all of the felony cases where there's a conflict with the public defender's office. That's a common system that you'll see in jurisdictions, where there might be the public defender's office that does all the felony defense work, but the same firm can't represent co-defendants usually. There's a conflict of interest. So they might have, they might farm out the work of the conflict cases, or you'll handle the felony cases that the public defenders can't handle because of conflicts. And then a final way to do it is to just have a list of individual attorneys who are sort of on call to take indigent defense cases on a case-by-case basis. You just get a phone call saying, okay, we have a robbery case. You can have this one robbery case. And you can bill your time at whatever, usually very, very low rate these lawyers are paid. There is some empirical evidence on this, but what I'm giving you is a gross summary of it. I mean, there's much more to be said about this. But I think there's a consensus out there that that list of attorneys who are just taking work case by case tends to be the worst way of doing it. You get the lowest quality attorneys doing that. And intuitively, that should make sense, right? The public defender's office is going to hopefully attract some people who just really want to do it. The true believers, what their cause is, and they're going to do this at least for a little while, if not a long while. It also has, you know, some security to it. It is a salaried job, even though it's a low salary, but it is a job that you know you're going to have a paycheck every 2 weeks or whatever it is. To contract it out, that stuff can actually be pretty lucrative. Some firms, you know, do pretty well. You handle all of the misdemeanors, UIs, and jurisdictions, you get paid $500 a pop. A lot of those are getting bled out super fast. You lose money on a trial, you make a ton of money on a plea. And all the UIs in a single county, that adds up. And that can be tons and tons and tons of money in a given year. That's pretty lucrative. If you're just on call, because maybe, you know, some robbery defendant needs a lawyer and can't afford one, and the court's going to call you and you've got to jump and say, okay, I'm going to take this one client on my own. That tends to be people who, let's just say, are not at the height of the bar, right? It tends not to be the cream of the crop. It's not the, you know, my guess is, trying to think of the famous celebrity attorney, Garagos or whatever. My guess is Garagos is not on this list to take things case by case on a misdemeanor for general felons. So, there are different ways to do this, but some people think are better than others, I guess. And overall, most people think that the stuff is underfunded. I mean, people get elected and politicians get points by going out and saying, be tough on crime, more cops on the street, longer sentences. That gets politicians rewarded. They usually don't get a lot of rewards for going out and saying, increase what we pay public defenders, give public defenders more investigators at their access, give them more experts. And there's usually not that kind of movement to spend a lot of public money helping defendants, right? It tends to not be the most sympathetic political cause in most jurisdictions. So. Okay, so the road to Gideon, you know, we've seen this in other contexts, right? When we start with the really early cases where the court had not yet incorporated a right. Correct? Okay. So prior to Gideon, the court was applying the Sixth Amendment right to counsel only to the federal government. So the Sixth Amendment, I mean, the court held in, I think, 1938 that the Sixth Amendment applied to federal trials and required court-appointed counsel for federal trials. So that really was not so much that issue. But that broad right to counsel, which included the right to court-appointed counsel for the indigent, was not yet applied to the state. When it came to a matter, when it came to the state, it came to a question of whether or not the state had to give court-appointed counsel to defendants. This looks familiar, right? The court would look not to the Bill of Rights that spoke to that, but instead to due process. Would look directly to due process, which prior to selecting the corporation was seen as providing sort of this lower level, kind of basic minimal level of fairness. And the question would be, is to try this person without a lawyer, is it so fundamentally unfair that it violates due process? If so, they've got to give them a lawyer. If not, they don't have to, even though the Sixth Amendment right to counsel might in the federal system. Powell versus Alabama, the famous example, one of the early due process cases on page 843 of your case book. This is the case involving the Scottsboro boys. I don't know if people have heard of this case or not. It's considered to be, you know, up there is one of the worst travesties during the post-Reconstruction era in terms of kind of the ugly history we have in this country having to do with race. There was a fight on the train involving boys, and what people think happened is one of the boys stepped on the hand of one of these other boys on the train, and they kind of got an argument about that. And it broke out into this fight and the tension, and these two girls that were with the boys who had been fighting with the Scottsboro boys wound up accusing nine black youths pretty young. I mean, I think the oldest was 19, and the youngest was 12. So we're only talking about pretty young kids here. These two white girls accused nine black men of gang raping them. And I'm sure you all know the history of that dynamic of the South well enough to realize the tensions that would have been involved in an accusation like that. And at the time the case went to trial, it was prior to Gideon, the court was still using this kind of case-by-case due process, fundamental liberties approach to asking whether or not the right to counsel had to apply in that particular case. This took place in Alabama. You know, I'm sure Alabama is a different place now. If anyone's from Alabama, sorry. At the time, you know, it's probably not the best place to be a young black male accused of raping a white girl. So the prosecution surrounding these boys are pretty explosive. There's a desire for vengeance, sort of this mob mentality down there. These guys were very much outsiders, not just by their race, but they were from another state. They didn't know anybody there. They were not very sophisticated. They were, for the most part, uneducated. They knew nobody, had nobody. They were real outsiders, not just by race and class, but literally geographic outsiders. And the trial judge, handling the case, had appointed the bar, just kind of generically. It is up to the local bar to provide representation to these defendants. He did not appoint any specific attorney, and in reality, no one took responsibility initially. The case was brought to trial within 2 weeks of the offense, which is really, really fast, in case you were wondering. And then the day of trial, two lawyers finally volunteered and said, okay, we'll do it. We'll represent these guys. One was from out of state and didn't know Alabama law. And the court denied their request for continuance. They said, okay, we'll do it, but we need more time. We don't know anything about the case. The court said, so what? You're going to trial. There was a one-day trial, and the defendants were sentenced to death. The court reversed the conviction. Oh, that's right. I did a little more research on it. I was trying to figure out what I'd written down. Sorry. I had to run the file. I'll confess. If I could take a pass, I would exercise one of my passes. Sorry about people out. So one of the lawyers was apparently drunk. Like, I read about this, that one of the lawyers was a real estate attorney and like 70 years old, not saying wrong being 70 years old, but 70-year-old real estate attorney was kind of drunk, so probably not at the top of his career, not the top of his game. But the court in Powell reversed, not because they were extending the Sixth Amendment rights counsel to the states, but instead, under the circumstances, you know, under a situation this dire, right, charges this serious, when the community was out of blood, and these kids were not sophisticated. It was a capital case, 2 weeks notice. The lawyers had no chance to prepare. It rendered them, the entire situation rendered them incapable of announcing their own defense. Right? They couldn't do it on their own because they were kids who didn't know anything, and it was a capital case, and they had no time, and therefore, under due process, they should have gotten a lawyer. But the famous language of Powell is when the court talks about, on page 845 of your case book, that language about the defendant requiring the guiding hand of counsel, still a language that you hear people talk about even now in the arguments about the adequacy of indigent defense in this country, is the importance of the guiding hand of counsel. And it always helps me, I think, to go back, and even though it's not a Sixth Amendment right to counsel case, even though it doesn't really look much doctrinally, like contemporary cases about indigent defense, particularly in the capital arena, when you go back and read Powell and they talk about what it is a lawyer can help with, why a lawyer is the guiding hand, it's not that they don't talk about getting a fairer jury or more time. I mean, there's something magical in the court's view about a lawyer. That's how you make the trial fair. Isn't by approving the trial in other ways. It's instead all about the guiding hand of counsel. But the court talks about how a lawyer is an investigator, right? It's not just a matter of knowing the rules of evidence and all of that, but they investigate. They can look into the validity of an indictment. They can challenge the admissibility of evidence. They can challenge the competency of evidence. So the court talks about all of these things that lawyers can do that, like, better or in a different way than lay people can do. And I was, I think of somebody who doesn't take it for granted being a lawyer. Like, it just seems like something you do. You know, until school for 3 years and then you're a lawyer. I mean, it's kind of nice to read about what makes us special as a profession, the special skills we have. And I like the way Powell talks, the court and Powell talks about the guiding hand of counsel, and you realize the importance of all that compared to a person trying to represent themselves in a case like this. So Powell really decided just on due process grounds, and the court continued on that road for a few years. The Facebook had that little note on 846 on Bennett versus Brady. The court was invited there to build on Powell about the importance of the guiding hand of counsel. They were invited to announce that there was a per se constitutional right to counsel, even in state cases, and the court refused. Court said, no, Powell's special. You've got to look at it case by case to decide whether it's a process violation. And in Bennett versus Brady, the defendant had been prosecuted for a robbery. He conducted his own defense because he couldn't afford to pay a lawyer, and he got convicted. And then he argued on appeal that he should have been entitled to indigent defense counsel. The court affirmed the conviction, despite what they had done to Powell, saying that this case, was different. There were no special circumstances that existed at best to require counsel. It was a relatively minor offense. It certainly wasn't a capital crime. Like in Powell, the defendant was an adult. He's not a little kid. He was of pretty ordinary intelligence. He wasn't particularly uneducated. And the court saw his defense, which was an alibi defense, as pretty uncomplicated. Why can't the lay person handle this? They can come in and present their alibi witness and do that on their own. They don't need anything special like a lawyer. He can do it himself. So for a while, the court resisted incorporating the Sixth Amendment right to counsel until you get to Gideon on page 847 of your case book. The defendant, this case looks a lot more like Bennett versus Brady than it does like Powell, right? I mean, you look at Powell and it's hard to make it any worse in terms of feeling like those kids needed someone to help defend them. Gideon's case is, pretty minor stuff, right? He was prosecuted for a B&E in a pool room. Definitely not a capital crime, it's pretty minor stuff. He handled his own defense because the court refused to appoint him a lawyer. And you don't have any of those special circumstances that warranted counsel in Powell, but nevertheless, the court reverses his conviction and overrules that. It's just interesting that the opinion, part of it is excerpted here, but even if you look at the whole opinion, it's not a very long opinion. Given some of the ones you've read, right? They go on and on and on and on. The court here, Black, usually is pretty terse with his words, but it just seems obvious to the court. By the time 1963 comes around, it's a very different court. Selective incorporation has kind of taken root. Incorporation is not considered such a bad thing anymore. Kind of the height of incorporation. And the court kind of, it seems obvious to the court that he can't get a fair trial unless he's got a lawyer. And the court makes the point that, look, states use lawyers to prosecute their cases. They don't just go out and stick an ad in the newspaper and say any old person can talk, right? They want people with legal training. They're willing to pay for it for their side. Wealthy people don't choose to defend themselves. People who can afford it go and spend big money on lawyers to defend themselves. It's clearly not a luxury. It's something that those who can afford it see as fundamental in the American court system, and so it should be given to people who can't afford it. It's necessary. The way our trials work, you can't get a fair trial unless you have a lawyer. The interesting postscript to Gideon that on remand, he was retried with a lawyer and got acquitted after an hour of deliberation. So apparently it actually did make a difference in Gideon's case. The scope of the right isn't really addressed in Gideon itself. It gets hammered out afterwards. The court has held that there is Gideon at least dealt with a felony. The court has applied it to misdemeanors as well. But the right to have counsel appointed is in any case where imprisonment of any length is actually imposed. Actually imposed. We're not doing a right to jury trial in this class. It does come up on the bar sometimes, so I'll just go ahead and just tell you what it is. I'm pointing this out not because you need to know for this class, but I just want to make sure you understand what the scope of the Gideon right is. The right to jury trial talks about the potential thing. If it's 6 months or more, then the defendant is entitled to a jury trial as opposed to a bench trial. But that has to do with the statutory potential sentence. So if you're in a jurisdiction where, for example, theft 3 has a maximum sentence of only 3 months, there wouldn't be right to a jury trial. If theft 2 has a maximum sentence of 6 months, then there would be a right to a jury trial on that charge. The right to counsel doesn't turn on the potential sentence, but on the sentence actually imposed. So if incarceration is actually imposed, even if it's one day, so how do courts administer that? What if the defendant is charged with theft 3 and there is a maximum sentence of 3 months in jail, but he hasn't been tried yet, let alone sentenced, and most defendants get probation? How does the trial judge know whether to give him a lawyer?
So, wasn't it say like that it forces the judges to evaluate the case before they bring the evidence to determine if they'll impose that sentence at the end of the trial before evidence? Which is it? I see what the test is.
Right. It doesn't make sense in a way because they post hoc test, right? It talks about the past test. It talks about somebody who's already been sentenced, and then you decide whether or not they need a lawyer for the trial that they already have. Okay, that doesn't really work. So the way it works in practice is, put it this way, if the judge does not give the defendant a lawyer, if he's up on theft 3 charges, and the judge refuses to give him a lawyer, what can he be sentenced to upon conviction?
Fine.
A fine. That's it, right? The judge can't put him in jail, because if he puts him in jail, he commits a Sixth Amendment violation. Okay, so it kind of ties the judge's hands on sentencing, depending on what he does with respect to the lawyer. In most jurisdictions, the way this works is the prosecutor's office will file those little shipping misdemeanors. They can either file them as misdemeanors, or they can file them as violations. And what they'll do is if they file it as a violation, they declare in the charging instrument that they're not going for jail. Right? That the most that can happen is the person's going to get a fine. And they make that decision ex ante before the person's convicted, before their sentencing, right? The state gives up its ability to ask for a jail sentence. And they just file it as a violation, and the repercussion of that is that then the judge doesn't have to give a lawyer. Right? So all in lots of jurisdictions, they just file it as a violation. It's a cheaper way to dispose of the case. There doesn't have to be court-appointed counsel. There certainly doesn't have to be a jury trial. It just goes on the same docket, a traffic ticket or something like that. Not in New York, it's a separate traffic court. It goes in onto a separate docket that goes super fast. There's no juries, there's no defense lawyers, you just go boom, 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 and people pay up $10 fines, whatever. So that's the way it works. Because the text is a little screwed. It talks about the sentence actually imposed when the defendant hasn't sentenced yet. So it kind of works backwards. So if incarceration is actually imposed at all, even one day. The right to jury trial is different. It looks at you just look at the statutory maximum sentence and that guy. The cases on this issue are Arbor Singer versus Hamlin, page 850 of your Facebook. The state had denied court-appointed counsel for the defendant when he was charged with a misdemeanor of carrying a concealed weapon. The statutory maximum sentence was 6 months. He was convicted and sentenced to 90 days. The state court thought that was okay, greater than 6 months. I think I messed that up before. It has to be greater than 6 months for jury trial. The state court had applied the jury trial scope and had said the statutory maximum sentence was only 6 months, not more than 6 months, so he doesn't get a jury trial. And then the court thought it was also okay to deprive him of a lawyer. And the court in Arbor Singer drew a different line. To the court, the right to a counsel is more fundamental to the fairness of a criminal trial than the right to a jury. Little tricky misdemeanor trials can be fair without juries as long as there's not more than 6 months of jail at stake, but no criminal trial is fair without lawyer. It's fundamentally unfair to send somebody to jail even for a day without giving them a lawyer. So the court interprets the right to counsel more richly. It does have to actually be imposed. This makes my point about violations. In Scott versus Illinois, page 851, the offense for which he was convicted was punishable by imprisonment. If you read the statute, the statutory maximum penalty included jail. But in actuality, the defendant only received a fine, and the court said that's not a problem. It's okay that he was tried without appointing counsel because he didn't go to jail. Long as he only gets a fine. Oh, I did want to point out, I think your case was has that. Alabama versus Shelton. Oh, on page 853, your case was right in the middle. That's a more recent case. The question there was whether a defendant who had not gotten court-appointed counsel could be given probation or a suspended sentence. For people who don't know, a suspended sentence is, okay, I'm going to sentence you to 90 days, but I'm going to suspend it. Be good, you know, for a year, because if you come back here within a year, I'm going to impose the suspended sentence. So the sentence is actually declared. Right, you do get a 90-day sentence, but I'm not going to make you serve it unless you get in trouble. And then when you get in trouble, that's going to be the sentence, that 90 days. It's kind of like probation. Probation, they don't actually say, like, this amount of days is suspended, but they might give a person, you know, 2 years probation, and for 2 years, you know, you have to be a good boy, and, you know, don't get in trouble. And if it's a driving case, they might say don't drink and drive, or whatever it is. And then if the person comes back in a probation violation, they can be sentenced all the way up to the maximum sentence of their underlying offense for which they're on probation. So the question in Shelton was whether or not probation or a suspended sentence could be imposed if the defendant hadn't appointed a lawyer. And the court held no. And I think that makes sense, right? Because at that point, they really are being sentenced to jail. It's not being imposed yet. Like it's hanging over their head, and they're at the whim of, it can be imposed on the defendant even if he doesn't commit a new crime. It can be put on him for violating some probation violation condition or something like that. So in a way, it has been imposed on him. So the court says you can't do that either. If incarceration is actually imposing for a day, including probation. Uh, When the right does apply, it applies only in critical cases. We've seen two of the more controversial ones there. In-person lineup, wait, and deliberate elicitation, Messiah. We know from Ash, right, we know from the United States versus Ash, that photographic identifications are not critical stages. Testing of forensic evidence isn't a critical stage. And the test here really is whether there's an opportunity for the lawyer to really do something significant and have a proper role to play, okay, or whether it can be done in some other way. Forensic testing, the lawyer can look at the reports, the lawyer can have his own experts, because if he doesn't have to be there while the police are doing their forensic test, there's no role for him to play. Right to counsel on appeal, I think I spared you the brief. Did I find a reading on that? I did. If I didn't show you, sorry. The post-trial stages of the right to counsel. The issues here are a little more complicated because if you look at the language of the Sixth Amendment, it talks about trials. It doesn't talk about appeals. I mean, sorry, it doesn't talk about trials. There's a criminal prosecution that doesn't talk about appeals. So the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, instead of the court dealing directly with it, to reach appeals, the court's jurisprudence here actually relies on due process and equal protection instead of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Griffin versus Illinois. The court held there, I don't like the way your book orders and stuff, because I don't think it gives you an idea of the historical evolution of how this stuff happened, so I'm going to jump around a little bit. Griffin versus Illinois dealt with transcripts, which may not seem like it matters, but it builds the road to a right to lawyer on appeal. But the court held in Griffin that in that jurisdiction, a defendant couldn't file an appeal unless he provided the appellate court a transcript of the trial. So, have any of you done internships or externships with appellate court judges? Okay, so a few of you have, right? Appellate court, it's all about reviewing the trial court record. You guys know this, right? There's no new testimony, there's not trials, there's no hearing. It's a matter of reviewing the record of what happened in the district court. So you really kind of get to know your way around the record, but you need to have the record. So, in Illinois, they required defendants who were representing themselves on appeal, they had to furnish a transcript to the appellate court, so the appellate court would have something to work with, and they were supposed to pay for that by themselves. And the court in Griffin reached to equal protection to strike that down. They said, look, in reality, what that does is close the courthouse doors to the indigent. People who can afford a transcript can appeal. People who can't afford the transcripts can't appeal. That's an equal protection violation. You can't do that. And they rely on a combination of both due process and equal protection, but not the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. In Douglas versus California, page 859 of your casebook, notice that after Griffin versus Illinois in time. I'm kind of giving you the evolution of the stuff by time and by page number. So, in Douglas versus California, the court dealt with the right to counsel on appeal. One thing that complicates this, I mean, just to make clear, there's no right to appeal in the Constitution. Right? We read the Sixth Amendment, it talks about the right to trial. It doesn't talk about a right for an appeal of that result from a trial. So there's actually no constitutional right to appeal a conviction at all. However, in reality, every state by statute does provide at least one level of appeal as a matter of right. And so if you think about the federal system, right, we have the trial court, the court of appeals, and it's Supreme Court. Once you go to a federal trial court, everybody can appeal to a court of appeal. Court of appeal doesn't get your case and choose and cherry pick their cases the way that the Supreme Court does. If you go to the trial court and get a jurisdiction, you can file a notice of appeal to the court of appeal as a matter of right. That's what I mean. The courthouse doors are not closed, they don't cherry pick. Not everyone gets to go to the Supreme Court. Right? And can you imagine the Supreme Court having to hear every single case of disaffected court of appeal living in the court now? The court of appeal has open doors, the Supreme Court gets to cherry pick. Every single state, in reality, even though there's no constitutional right to appeal, provides at least one level of intermediate appellate court that is open as a matter of right, that's not cherry-picked, that takes automatically, you know, any notice of appeal filed from their trial court. So the court has held not that there is a right to counsel on appeal, because that suggests that there's a right to appeal. Instead, what the court held in Douglas was that if a jurisdiction provides a right of appeal, if it provides a level of appeal as a matter of right, they have to provide counsel for that appeal as a matter of right. And it uses very much the same analysis of the court in Griffin versus Illinois with the transcript. Otherwise, in reality, you're opening the courthouse doors to people who can afford lawyers, but not opening the courthouse doors to people who can't afford lawyers. So if there is an appeal as a matter of right, lawyers have to be provided, and that was the analysis in Douglas versus California. Now, notice the implication of that is that it's the right of counsel that exists on appeal, not on the Sixth Amendment, but on under due process and equal protection, is only limited to appeals that exist as a matter of right. So if a defendant appeals to the Second Circuit in a federal case, loses his appeal, and wants to go up to the Supreme Court, no one has to provide him a lawyer. The state does not at that point have to provide him a lawyer to help him with that. If he wants to file a habeas petition after his direct appeals have been exhausted, he wants to sue and file a habeas petition collaterally attacking his conviction, he doesn't get a right to counsel on that either. None of that is an appeal as a matter of right. I think that's all. Do they have questions on that? I should probably mention Memphis versus Ray. Sorry. Memphis versus Ray, page 837 of your Facebook. Deals with the right to counsel at probation violations. The court held there that court-appointed counsel has to be provided. Some jurisdictions call it probation violation hearing, some call it deferred sentencing. And the court says there's really no difference between those two. A deferred sentencing arrangement is kind of like a suspended sentence. Like, for now, we'll defer sentencing. People like that because they don't like being sentenced because that means they're in jail. So we'll defer sentencing, and then if you're good, you don't have to be good. If you're not so good, then we're going to sentence you. It's the same really as a probation violation in every substantive way. So the court says that they are constitutionally equivalent. Okay, so are there any questions on the basic right to counsel? Right, I think I'll put off talking about the effectiveness of... Oh, because I didn't find a reading. So we're just caught up. So I guess I shouldn't have reduced your reading. So we'll have a pretty laid-back class, I think, on Tuesday, right, before Thanksgiving. So that middle line on assessing prejudice, you can take that out. So we'll just talk about the basic structure for evaluating the effectiveness of counsel. Those cases are actually kind of fun to talk about. They're sort of depressing if you realize how many bad lawyers are out there. And they're kind of fun. And we'll talk about self-representation, which is also kind of fun. I need to just our giving thought. I do actually sometimes prepare, because of the day I kind of leave. But I prepare a lot for your review class. The last class of the semester will just be purely review, no new reading. And what I do is, I mean, obviously, if I could teach you everything you need to know about SkrimPro in 2 hours, I would do that, right? I would do this party every day. But I can't teach you all in 2 hours, so it's going to be true review. So if you know you have questions, email me, and I'll try to work it into the review. If it's a level of detail that I can't get to, you know, I'll answer you by email, or we can talk about it separately. But it would help me to kind of know what you're confused about, so that I can maybe try to work it into the review. But anyway, I'll see you guys soon. Have a good weekend.
She argues that people get really. Thank you. can't.
No, we don't come, so we were definitely.
Okay. I think we've got another one here.
There you go.
Thank you.